Are people able to read the DNA and protein files into whichever program you're using on the homeworks?
Yeah, and I had a question, and maybe it's just my misunderstanding or something I missed in class. So when you run the protein sequences, is there a reason why they will only run under sequential addition? Like you have to change that setting? Because for me, when I didn't change that setting, it would be out of alignment. But then when I changed that setting, it would run through.
I think that what's not clear is that it isn't sequential addition.
Okay.
It's sequential format.
Okay.
And the idea of sequential format just is it's a format where you have the name and the entirety of the DNA sequence on different lines, then the next name and the entirety. Okay. Interleaved format is the name and the first part of the DNA sequence, the other name, you know, all the first parts, then all the second parts, then all the third parts. Those are just arbitrary names, somewhat arbitrary names, and probably it makes you feel you're doing some. Well, when you're computing distances, there's no such thing as sequential addition because you're not making a tree, you're just making distances. So it's just two different formats, and if you tell it the wrong format, it gets confused and it starts reading characters in the name as part of the sequence, and thereafter things go wrong. One of the things that happens on my programs is when it gets confused about the format of a file, it tends to think, particularly when you feed in stuff like in a Microsoft Word format or something when you're not supposed to, it gets confused and thinks it needs space for a million species, and then it goes and tries to allocate memory space for millions of species, and then the computer rolls over and dies. And everybody thinks, oh, there isn't enough memory, and I've had people in the past who went out and bought more memory for their computer. There is no amount of memory you could ever buy that would solve that problem. Mm-hmm. The file's just in the wrong format. But I don't think you're probably having that problem because you're probably feeding the text files in. But yeah, I think the way we have it set up on some of those files would work on either sequential or interleaved because it's the name followed by the entire sequence on one long line, and that'll actually fit either sequence. Either, but just to be safe, tell it it's sequential, and then it'll read them correctly. But as everybody, you're not having the problem that we had before, which is I had given you files that wouldn't even read into my own programs. I'm sorry there was that delay. If anybody tried to do the thing early, please.
Ask a real quick question about.
Yeah.
So the question mark versus the hash in the protein code disk. When I replaced all the dashes, I made stop code on the question mark, it didn't work. But if I leave them as dashes, it does.
I'm surprised.
I might have made some error or something.
Well, maybe, but what happens is dash means a gap.
Right.
So there's been alignment and there's a gap there, so something either got inserted or deleted. Question mark means unknown nucleotide.
Right.
There's also other symbols like N for unknown nucleotide. The problem is that the programs we're running will actually treat those two symbols the same. Whenever it's computing a distance between two sequences, if one position has a question mark or a dash, it just doesn't use that position. It's as if the sequence were one base shorter. And by the way, it doesn't mean that it's dropping that position from all comparisons, just from that one comparison. So I would think that replacing question dashes by question marks would make no difference. However, if something went wrong with the edit, then you could. The programs are very easy to confuse.
Okay.
Did anybody try to run those sequences through into somebody else's program, like Mega, for example? Does that work?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're okay for that then. And Mega presumably has protein distances as well. So and it should be some of the same select. Knowing Sudhir Kumar, who wrote that program, he probably has more options for different kinds of distances, of protein distances, than I do. But I haven't looked to see. Yeah?
If there are any gaps, does it renormalize to to make all the, like, would the distance appear different, that sequence that has a gap in it?
It shouldn't. Whenever it sees a question mark or a gap, the way the program is intended to work is to sort of say, it's as if that sequence were one base shorter, mm-hmm. and we just forget about that base. So as you say, it won't change either the numerator or the denominator. Oh, it'll make them... What it won't do is count that as a difference. People often make that mistake. They say, oh, you've got gaps in there, so the sequences are going to be very far apart. No. Actually, there is information in the presence and absence of gaps, but when you get into taking it into account, its life gets very, very hard. You'll find some material on this. I think it's in chapter 29 of the book. And there's a whole literature on statistical alignment. And unfortunately, the methods aren't, it's not that they aren't well developed. People have tried very, very hard, and there's some intractability. But you have to not just have models that put gaps in at individual sites. You have to take into account that gaps, bunches of, mm-hmm. Chunks of nucleotides can be deleted or inserted. And those can later on overlap. They can be partially overlaid by others. And that leads you to a whole statistical alignment methodology that involves summing up over your uncertainty about the alignment. There are programs out there using like Markov chain Monte Carlo to do that. They're very heroic efforts, but the models somehow people have been unable to calculate some of the transition probabilities they need to, even though they tried very hard. So, but for the moment, a gap is not a difference. It's not going to make the distance bigger. That information just gets ignored, and we just use the aligned nucleotides or aligned amino acids. Okay, other questions about homework-ish kinds of things? Okay, we're going to move on to other more biologically realistic nucleotide DNA models, and we're coming in later on to protein models too, at least briefly. And I mentioned to you that the first one that was done in 1980, Moto Kimura, who's famous as the leading proponent of the neutral mutation theory and the guy who, well, he was really, after the three founders, of the three great figures of theoretical population genetics, Fisher, Wright, and Haldane, he was really the most important theoretical population geneticist. But along the way, when he was comparing DNA sequences in different species, he just had a little paper where he did this. It's one of his least important papers, actually. And there you have a model that says everything's symmetrical. When you change, there's a certain rate at which you would change to the, if you're a pyrimidine, as this is, that you change to the other pyrimidine. But that, and that's symmetrical back and forth between the two pyrimidines. And there's the same thing going on between purines. And then when you change a different and probably lower rate of change, beta, takes you to one of the two other, if you're a purine, it takes you to one of the two other pyrimidines. If you're a pyrimidine, it takes you one of the two purines. And it's all symmetrical. So one of the things that won't be very hard to see is that if you run this model for a long time and just ask what sequences does it generate in the long run, starting from any old sequence, if you run it long enough, it loses its history and ultimately just approaches a random sequence. And a random sequence under this model is still a sequence with equal frequencies in the four bases. But now the changes among them are biased in favor of more transitions in the molecular sense. And the transitions are biased to be more transitions and fewer transversions. Those are the two different uses of the word transition. There's algebra you can do very nicely with this. One of the things you might be interested in is the overall expected rate of ratio of transition changes to transversion changes. If the rates are alpha and beta, this is the relationship between them. What it does is there's two different betas that can, two different events that can happen at rate beta and one at rate alpha. So the ratio between these works out to a quantity R. And so you get a parameter to set that's the ratio of transitions to transversions. And so the model is different for different values of that parameter. By the way, the Jukes-Cantor model, which is when alpha equals beta, then it's the Jukes-Cantor model. And then R, the capital R, is, oh, let's see, capital R is 1/2 in the Jukes-Cantor model. And you can't go below 1/2. So there's the relationship between them. The thing that this does also is standardize these rates so that the overall rate of change is 1. So the overall, the scale, the time scale is such that 1 unit of time is the time in which the a nucleotide that you're looking at suffers on the whole 1 change. That's the convenient rescaling that people use. And when you do this, you can make an argument. I had this argument that I gave you for the Jukes-Cantor model where we had fictional events that included changing to yourself. And we adjusted their rate to just replicate the Jukes-Cantor model, and then we could easily figure out the transition probabilities. You can do the same for this model, but you now have to two kinds of fictional events. One is like the Jukes-Cantor one, and the other is that if you're a purine, you change to a randomly selected purine, including possibly yourself. And if you set up those models, you can calculate the transition probabilities, and there is discussion of this. Well, I think in the book, it's when we get to the next more complicated model, which includes this model, I tell you exactly how to do that. The upshot is that if you ask yourself, what's the probability after branch length t, branch length being in scaled in units of expected changes, what's the probability that after that length of branch, you end up with a change that's a transition in the molecular sense? And it's this formula here in terms of that R thing, 1 minus 1/2 e to the minus whatnot plus 1/4 e to the minus something else. The net probability of a transversion is this other expression. I'm counting both kinds of transversions here, so a particular transversion, like do you go from A to C, is 1/2 that. So you can work out the net probabilities of change under this model, and that gives you the pieces that you would need. Let me show you what it looks like. Here's a plot for two values of R. One of them is for 10, and I'm going to show you another one that's for 2. 10 is a very strong bias in favor of transitions. It's actually not strong enough to be mammalian mitochondrial DNA, which is very strongly biased towards transitions, but it's getting there. And what you'll see is here's the branch length. I call it time, but it's really branch length. And it's getting big here. I mean, one, when you get out to here, you've had on average, 1 change per site. That's a lot of change. So we're getting out to very long branches here when you get out to like 3. But down in here, if you have shortish branches, at first, the differences that are transitions and the differences that are transitions going up linearly, which is what you'd expect if you just get single changes, no changes really overlaying each other or reversing each other or converting one to another. So you get, this slope is in fact 10 times, let's see, this slope is in fact 10 times that slope. So down here, it's straightforward. Then as time goes by, the number of transversions you see keeps rising. It will plateau at, let me just get this straight, at 1/2. Because if you take a sequence and you change it and change it and change it and it becomes completely unrelated to the original sequence, the probability that the net change at a site is a transversion is one half, because there are four possibilities. A quarter of the time it'll be the same nucleotide. Another quarter it'll be the other event that's a transition, and then the rest of the time, a half, it'll be transversion. So this is going to rise and rise and rise. If you go out to really long branches, it'll get up to 0.5. Transitions go up quickly, then they actually start coming down, the net transitions. Why is that? Well, because later events convert them to transversions. And so it actually rises and then falls. Total differences do go up. They do continue to go up. And when you get up around, in this case, 40, around 50% difference somewhere up in here, you're up in the range where further branch length is not actually affecting how many transitions there are that you're seeing. And what you can do is argue from that, that out here for these long branches, it's transversions that give you all the information. That transitions have gotten almost insensitive to branch length, the number of them. But if we make a plot like this for a different value of R, for 2, now 2 is closer to what mammalian nuclear DNA has a ratio of something like 2. Then you see similar plot. Initially, twice as many transitions as transversions. So you see them going up essentially linearly, but one at twice the slope of the other. So slope of the other. Transitions plateau out. In this range, transitions won't tell you very much. It actually is also somewhere near 50% total difference that happens. It's not quite the same. And transversions keep rising. Transitions are going to go up, get up to about 30%, then they're going to come down, and they approach 25% from above. And on the other one, they're also going to approach 25% from above. And transversions are going to go up to 50%. So you can see that they're giving you somewhat different information. For short branches, people often say, well, it's transitions that give you all the information. Actually, it's not quite true. They both give you information. It's just there are more transitions. When you're in the long branches, it's transversions that are giving you the information, how many transversion differences there are, and how many transition differences won't have much information in it. Then you might say, well, okay, if these two kinds of events are giving you different information, and it depends upon R, what do we do? Yeah.
Well, you said that.
Which may be the question you're about to ask, yeah.
No. Well, you said that transversions are more informative for longer branches, and that makes sense in the last graph when R equals 10, but here,
yeah.
I don't understand why that would be.
Well, for example, if I look at some data in which one comparison is about here,
mm-hmm.
say 1.4 length, a branch of length 1.4, and another is a branch of length 2.8, which is twice as long, they'll predict about the same amount of transition difference, but they will differ in how many transversions they have. So I would argue that to the extent that knowing whether it's that is really 1.4 long, whether it fits a tree that, say, predicts the length to be 1.4, or fits better a tree that would predict the length to be 2.8, you won't get much out of looking at transitions once you're in that range. I saw various hands coming up, but.
You look at it like with the long branches where the transition information isn't available, that you're losing information, and if you could get more species or something, if you could shorten those branch lengths by including more analysis, you could have more information.
You would have more information. I mean, adding species is adding information, and yes, It's often true for phylogeny methods, not just, it's for parsimony, it's for all of them, that adding something that will hook in and break up a long branch is often very helpful. And so, yes, although quantitating that gets to be tricky, but you're, intuitively, yes, it's correct, yeah. Yes?
Is this distinction important for the programs? Like, do they care about transversions, transitions, as long as the total differences are being, like, for inference, does it matter?
Well, the programs have built, well, a parsimony program doesn't care, okay. A distance program, although parsimony programs, you can make weighted parsimony in which you count one more than the other. Mm-hmm. But if you don't weight, have an unweighted parsimony, it won't matter. For distance methods and likelihood methods and Bayesian methods, they all have a probability model built in. Now, distance methods is not built into the distance program, it's built into the thing that calculates the distance. If you calculate the distance using a Jukes-Cantor model, you have declared that it doesn't matter, and it will compute it as if it doesn't matter. And then, yes, it will pay attention. But at this point, we're right at the point where I'm trying to see if I put a panel on that. Yes. You can compute distances that reflect this model. And if you know a value, well, let's see. You can compute a distance that uses the fraction of differences that are transition and transversion. And that was what Kimura did in 1980, was come up with these formulas. So for two sequences, you could say, I can get a distance between them and at the same time an estimate of what R is. Out of that, maybe you don't care as much about the R, but here is the, this is really supposed to be estimated branch length, where P and Q are the observed fractions of transition differences and transversion differences. It, by the way, those are the sufficient statistics. You don't have to know which kind of transversion you see. They're all have equal implications. Now, you might think that, oh, that's fine, then we can go ahead with the Kimura distance, and on my programs, well, that's one of the choices. I suspect that in Mega it is also, and other packages that do that. There is a little issue, though, for when I go to do the next distance, I say I do humans and chimps, and I get numbers here. The next one I do human and gorilla, okay. So I tote up what Q and P are for those, and I do these formulas. I get out a distance for human and gorilla, that's fine, but I also get an estimate of R, and it isn't the same. So the noise will, you know, if the sequences were incredibly long, they would all converge, and they really evolved under this model, they would all converge on very consistent Rs. For more real sequences, the Rs can bounce around. Which is okay. You can just kind of ignore that and say, "Well, we'll use the distances anyway." Alternatively, now I should say, let me back up. In my computer program, we don't actually do this. We feed in a value of R. Now you may say, "Well, where do we get the value of R?" And that's a bit of a dilemma. There isn't a simple answer to that. There are maximum likelihood schemes where you can estimate R as you estimate the tree. But in distance methods, you don't really get a clean estimate of that. Let me just see. Yes, the thing you can do that's done in my programs is to do the distances given R by maximum likelihood. Now we, again, haven't... This is the second time likelihood has been introduced in the course, or maybe the third time, and we haven't introduced it yet. This isn't the introduction of it yet, but it's basically going to compute the probability of having the two sequences given that the branch that separates them is of length T, and the transition-transversion ratio is of length R. And it turns out you can work out the expression for that, and it's really just a sort of binomial expression. I won't go through it. And you can say, okay, for given amounts of P and Q, what is the likelihood? And then you may say, well, wait a second, I don't see the time here. I don't see the branch length here. And the answer is, we gave you expressions a little earlier for P and what P and Q are expected to be. Let's see, where are they? Back here. This is P and that's Q. So we have expressions for them that involve R and T. So these are functions of R and T. So then you take the R, which you're assuming known, and you take the T and you just vary it and maximize the likelihood. And it's not, I think there's no explicit formula for it, but it's very easy to do numerically. It's just a curve and you're finding the highest point on the curve. It's a one-dimensional optimization problem that's very quick. So you can either know R and do this, do a likelihood-based estimate of the distance. So you're basically doing a maximum likelihood estimate of a two-species tree. Or you can compute, you can estimate R as you do it and use Kimura's formulas. Anyway, so those are possible ways. Okay, the thing can be generalized. We're headed into complicated formula land, but I'm not going to ask you to memorize these. There's another model called, there's a family of models that are called the Tamura-Ney model. And particular versions of those that were defined earlier in the literature are F84, which I defined, and HKY, which was Hasegawa, Kishino, Yano, 1985. And all of them have the following property. They all fit. These are all subcases of the Tamura-Ney model. The Tamura-Ney model, if you look at a very short stretch of branch, it has probabilities of change that are the length of that stretch of branch, a little slice dt, let's say. So it's a little time period, times rates, and these are the rates in the table here. And if you look at them, it just looks too complicated. But really, what it involves is this model does not lead to equal frequencies of the four bases. It leads to arbitrary frequencies. So there are parameters in there, which we're calling pi A, pi G, pi C, and pi T, that are the target frequencies of the bases. This is a theoretical model. It's the target sequences it will arrive at if an infinitely long sequence is being evolved for an infinitely long time. Then you're going to fit this to the data. So what it has is rates of, when you do transversions, which are changing from either A, you have to look at this order here. It's the two purines followed by the two pyrimidines. If you change between them, they're rather simple rates. If you change within each of those categories, there's an extra term involving alpha. I won't go over the rationales of those terms or the algebra. You can go into the book and it will be in exhaustive detail there. So what this model is it's like the Kimura model in that it has extra change between the purines and extra change between the pyrimidines. But now, instead of having symmetry and you get equal frequencies of the four bases, you go to a particular set of base frequencies that are involved in the parameters of the model. And I should mention here, there's also a frequency of something called R. R is the symbol in the DNA code for purine. And Y is the symbol for pyrimidine. So what those are the target frequencies of purines and pyrimidines. So pi R is just the sum of pi A plus pi G. And pi Y is the sum of pi C and pi T. So given the base target frequencies, And actually, given a target transition transversion ratio, you can work out what these quantities are. And then the question is, can you compute the probability, the net probability of change along a branch? Is there a formula for it? Well, I wouldn't be raising the question unless there was. I will not go through all this, except to say, in terms of those parameters, you can work out the rate of transitions and the rate of transversions, or the ratio of those is R. You can take that and the target frequency, the R and the target frequencies, and go back the other way, and these are the formulas for going the other way. There is also, in this model, let me go back to it because there's an important thing. There's extra probability of transition between purines and extra probability of change between pyrimidines, but there's a parameter in there, alpha y. There's two parameters, alpha r and alpha y, so that you get to separately adjust those. You can say, well, change between purines is pretty fast, but change between pyrimidines not so fast. You have a parameter to adjust that. That's what the tamarine does for you. And the particular values, there are particular values of them that lead to the F84 and the HKY models. So HKY is a very widely used model. It's got extra change between purines and between pyrimidines. It's got target base frequencies. The tamarine model is a little more general. It's one parameter more general. Now, when you use all that, the next few slides are talking you through the way you compute the transition probabilities, but I'm going to skip over that. It's in the book. You end up with, blah, 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 and finally, you end up several slides down, that you can compute the probability that in a branch of length T, that you, if you're an A, that you end up at a G. And it's once again a sum of exponential things. And they involve these target base frequencies, and they involve these rates of purine change and rates of pyrimidine change and rates of overall change. And in the model, things are scaled. So again, one unit of branch is one expected change per nucleotide. You can do that. And again, skipping over, doing more, it can be shown that you can work out a general expression for what's the probability that starting at base I, you end up at base J, and it's one of these expressions with all those parameters in it. Plus, it has a little bookkeeping thing here, delta IJ, which is 1 if the two bases are the same and 0 if they aren't, and another bookkeeping thing called epsilon, which is 1 if they're both pyrimidines, 1 if they're both purines, and 0 otherwise. So this is the sort of general expression for all the formulas of change from one nucleotide to another. Okay, you may say, well, thanks for telling us that, but so what? The models work. You can compute transition probabilities on them. They have the biological realism of, you can run them for DNA. If a DNA happens to have very high AT and very low GC or something like that, you just adjust the parameters and you can you'll have a model that is for the evolution of DNA that remains biased in favor of ATs and against GCs, let's say. So the model's fairly flexible and can handle those sorts of things, but not infinitely flexible. Let me see. Now, we can go a little on and say, well, can you give us a more general model than that? And the answer is I can. I'll show you in a moment how many degrees of freedom each of these models has. There is a model you can make called the general time reversible model. It actually is fairly widely used. It is not available in my programs because of all the work I'd have to do to put it in. But it is available in other programs. I think you'll find it in Mega, and I think David Swofford's Popstar will have it. He just goes to the effort. And it has a property that it's the most general model you can make that has a particular property. And this particular property is called reversibility. It's a mathematical convenience. It's not necessarily true of real DNA. And what the condition for reversibility in any stochastic process is this thing. And what it means is, let's imagine we have a model of base change. It reaches certain equilibrium probabilities if you run it long enough. Those probabilities are pi's. So for state I, it's pi sub I is the probability in the long run that you'll be in that state, similarly pi sub j. It has transition probabilities that you can compute, transition in the mathematical, not the molecular sense, in either direction. And it satisfies this condition that says the probability of starting with J and also changing to I is this thing on the right. So it's the probability that the first nucleotide is a J, and then after you run it for length T, the result is an I. If that's equal to the corresponding probability going the other way, then you're reversible. That's the probability of starting with I and ending up with J. And what it means is that if I look at two, if somebody were to say, I have just watched evolution happen, and I recorded the initial DNA sequence, then I waited a million years, and I recorded the final DNA sequence. And here are the two DNA sequences, the one that was started with and the one that you ended with. And I say, thank you very much. And then I drop the data and pick it up again. And I say, wait a second, I just forgot which is the first one and which is the second one. Which was the original sequence and which was the second? Well, unless they tell me, I cannot tell by looking at them. The probability of starting with this sequence and ending with that sequence is the same as the probability of starting with that sequence and ending with this sequence. That's reversibility. So reversibility gives you that. It removes your ability essentially to tell where the root is. Between two species in a two-species tree, is the root at the first species? Is it at the second? Is it somewhere in between? The answer is you can't tell.
So is that for each nucleotide position or for an entire sequence?
Both.
Okay.
Because if it's true for each nucleotide position, it's also true for the whole sequence.
So it works for like synonymous changes, but not like that's a good.
I'm not sure I'd say that. I mean, you can have reversibility and have a model in which there's a distinction between synonymous and non-synonymous changes. Now, people may look at that and say, well, is this a biological constraint? It's not dictated by the biology, it's dictated by the math working out nicely. Now, I have a general principle that I live by. It's one of the great founding, it's one of the great principles by which I live my life, and that is reality fits our biological models. And if it doesn't, so much the worse for reality. You know, if it doesn't fit our biological models, I'm going to ignore that. Okay. That's I've had a very successful career ignoring reality. Okay. Now, it's sort of close enough in a lot of cases that you don't do too much violence by assuming it. So what would be a model that didn't, that wasn't reversible? And here's one that won't be reversible. Suppose it were true that the nucleotides are kind of in an alphabetic order, and so A's will mostly change to C's. C's will mostly change to G's, although sometimes to something else. G's will mostly change to T's, and T will change back to A, mostly. If that were the case, and I gave you two sequences, you could stare at them and say, ah, this one must have come first. Because A's in it tend to have G's in the other sequence, and C's in it tend to have T's. A's tend to have C's. C's tend to have G's. G's tend to have T's. We can tell which one comes first and which one comes later. That would be a non-reversible model. Fortunately, reality isn't that extreme, and it's close enough to these reversible models that we can get away with it a lot, particularly if no one really looks. Now, can you make a model that's very general, has this reversibility property? You can. Here is the set of rates for it. They have a whole bunch of parameters. They have parameters for the four nucleotide frequencies, those are the pi's, and then they've got an alpha, a beta, a gamma, a delta, and an epsilon, and whatever that thing is, an epsilon. Epsilon, somebody knows the Greek alphabet. Tell me what that thing is. Eta? Epsilon?
Epsilon.
Which?
I think it's epsilon.
Epsilon, okay. Alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, epsilon. Okay. Those same six parameters come over here. So it's got three, it's got base frequency parameters plus six more. So it's got lots of parameters in it. Now, can you compute a transition probability for this? The naive answer is no. The actual answer is yes, you can, but you don't want to do it. Because what you can do is you can take this thing and you can work out its eigenvalues, and you get a, for those who know about eigenvalues and eigenvectors, you can work out the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and the characteristic equation that gets you the eigenvalues is a cubic. And yes, in the books you will find a formula for solving a cubic exactly. You may recall looking at it in high school, and you will have concluded, yeah, you can do it, but I wouldn't want to. That formula is too ugly. It's got great big, lots of cube roots and all sorts of things going on. So in theory, you can actually compute transition probabilities. In practice, people do it numerically, don't even use those formulas most of the time. So this is sort of tractable. It has a lot of parameters, and you have to feed in values for them or estimate them. So you can use it. If you do, yeah, here's the GTR model sort of with colors. It's got, actually I have a different colors for the different Greek letters, except I seem to have used the same color for gamma as for delta. So maybe I should make those different colors.
They're different.
Those are two, oh, you're right, they are different. I was, yeah, they're different. Okay, so they're all different colors, lots of parameters. In principle, you can get transition probability formulas for it. No one actually ever does. You have to constrain some of those parameters to get the overall rate of change. You want to scale everything so the overall rate of change is one. This is the formula for scaling. And then you might say, okay, how do we actually get distances from this thing? There is a way. Now, I'm just going to skim real quickly over it. It's in the book. It's a pain. What I did is I simulated some data under a Kimura two-parameter model. That's the symmetrical one with the excess of transitions over transversion. And you may say, well, why'd you do that? We're talking about GTR. And the answer is, because the Kimura model is time reversible, so is HKY, so is F84, so is tumor-NA. They're all, so is Jukes-Kander. They're all time reversible. So it's a special case of time reversible. So here is data that was simulated with a true branch length of 0.2, so an expectation of 0.2 changes per site, a true transition transversion ratio of 2, and then I just tabulated for 500 bases of simulated sequence. How many pairs was one an A and the next one a G? 13. One an A and the other one a C? 3, and so on. There's the table of outcomes. The distance you calculate will just depend on this table. Well, it turns out there is a way. If you average across the diagonal, which under reversibility you're supposed to be able to do, you get this table. And you can work out, there's dividing each column by its sum. There is a way to get a rate matrix estimated from this. These would be the rates under the, with all those parameters in, estimated in this case. The diagonals are negative, they're supposed to be. We before were just showing you the off-diagonal stuff. But anyway, you could estimate them by taking the logarithm of the table that I showed you with averaging across the diagonals. You take the log of that, and you may say, what do you mean take the log of a matrix? Do you just take the logs of its individual elements? And no, you don't. You get eigenvalues, you get eigenvectors, you take logs of the eigenvalues, and you put the matrix back together. It's doable, and there are formulas for it in languages like R. Not that you'll ever really have to use them. You had your hand up.
Yeah, I don't know what that symbol means on top of the P.
Oh, the hat is a little thing meaning estimate of. It's an old fashioned way of saying this is not the true thing, but the thing we're estimating. So your estimate of this rate matrix times time is this thing, and then there's formulas that say the overall estimate of the branch length is the minus the trace of log p times the diagonal matrix of observed base frequencies. And then there is a formula for the overall estimate of the rates. Okay. Now, you don't have to remember this. You don't have to know this, except that it can be done. And that can be done, actually, without knowing in advance what all those rates and frequencies are. In the particular numerical case that I got, we end up with an estimate of the rates in this thing here. If you look at the actual K2P model that I used to do the simulation, its rates are here. Now, take a look at them. The diagonals are all supposed to be minus 1. They aren't, but some of them are below 1 and some of them are above 1. This number here is supposed to be 2/3. It's 0.48 or 0.52. Those are supposed to be 2/3. 0.9 and 0.77. If you actually average those four, they're not too far from 2/3. If you average these blocks here, they're all supposed to be 1/6. They average out pretty well too. So one is making a kind of successful estimate. In this case, where we really know what the truth was, and it was a Kimura two-parameter model. Now, all of these models that I've been showing you have parameters. There is another model you can use called the general 12-parameter model. What that just says is it's some kind of Markov process with rates. It isn't reversible. What's the most general model you can make? And it turns out to have 12 parameters. But it's kind of intractable. Nobody really can do things with that. What we were talking about is the general time reversible model. How many parameters did that have? It had 4 different base frequencies, but they have to add to 1. So there are 3 parameters worth of base frequencies. Then it had 6 other parameters. So it's total of 9 parameters. You can make one of those go away by requiring that the total rate of change be 1, but I haven't done that here. Tamura-Ne has 6 parameters because it has 3 base frequencies plus a transition transversion rate plus 2. One is the rate of change among purines and the rate of change among pyrimidines. So it has 6. When you restrict further, you get HKY and FAD4. Those have 5 parameters each. Kimura 2-parameter had 2 parameters, alpha and beta. Jukes-Kantor had 1 parameter, which is just the rate of change. So all of these form a sort of nested set. By restricting more and more, you go from this general time reversible down to all these particular models. Now, there are many other models. You can drive yourself crazy, and there are review articles where people have done that. But these are probably the most frequently used models. Yeah?
So, for example, if you have a
for the general time reversible model, there's not a way to say, to mathematically say, you know, every third base is, or nucleotide position is totally reversible.
What you're getting at, there's an ulterior reason why you use the word third.
Right.
You were thinking about proteins, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to get to proteins, and we're going to get to models that are specific to proteins.
Okay.
So we will do that. The other thing we're going to go on to do, which I think we go on to do immediately, but not just not today, obviously, is to ask how can you deal with the fact that some positions in the DNA are changing much faster than others, usually because of constraint, functional constraint of some sort. We're gonna especially talk about protein coding sequences, but there are other reasons why things might go faster and slower. Is there a machinery for dealing with that? And I'm going to tell you about that probably next time, and then move on towards the protein stuff. Okay. So we'll stop there.